Hey friends, welcome to Body Image with Bree. I am Bree, a licensed mental health counselor in the state of New Jersey, and a body image and eating disorder recovery coach. This podcast is designed to help you make peace with your current body. Join me as we explore the ins and outs of diet culture, body image, and learning how to love the skin you're in. Hey, and welcome to another episode of Body Image with Bree. I just want to take a moment to thank all of you listeners who are following this podcast. I know it's been a minute since I've produced an episode, and I just want you to know that I have big plans for this podcast, and I am in process of just making sure I can get these amazing episodes out in a timely way. So I have some episodes that I'm sitting on, and I'm super pumped to bring them to you. As a reminder, this podcast can only serve as informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. I'm super pumped to bring you today's episode. I interviewed my friend Suzanne, and her bio includes that she is a family nurse practitioner who prioritizes health equity and strives to eliminate health disparities due to social position, race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, education, ability, or body size. As the associate medical director of a community health center in New Jersey, she has proven to be a resourceful leader who thrives in an ever-changing demands of healthcare field. Her hobbies include joyful movement, knitting, reading, and entertaining her two cats. We had an amazing conversation about her work as a nurse practitioner, as well as her own life experience, and I think that you will all be able to take away a lot from this episode. So without further ado, let's talk to Suzanne. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Body Image with Bree. I am so excited to introduce you to my guest today, Suzanne Johnson, who is a nurse practitioner in the state of, well, she I think she practices in New Jersey, but she lives in Philadelphia. So let's meet my guest. Hi, welcome, Suzanne.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited
to be here.
Oh, it's going to be so great. Thank you. So you know, I always start off my podcast episodes this way. Can you tell me about a time recently where you had body image discomfort or a bad body image day?
Sure. I think, I don't know if this has been several days over the course of the pandemic, because we've been spending a lot more time at home, and I was definitely having some issues regulating the way I fed myself, being at home more and just feeling stressed and fatigued and sad, and noticed that I wasn't eating meals as regularly as I should be, and that my clothes were fitting more loosely. And because of my eating disordered history and my experience with diet culture, this light bulb goes off in my head that's like, oh, good job. This is great. And so wanting to keep that going. Mm-hmm. So it goes from being a stress response to then almost something that I purposely try to perpetuate. And, you know, in my 30s, I've been struggling with the development of lipedema in my thighs. Mm-hmm. And so definitely there are just some days I come out of the shower and I'm getting ready in my bathroom and I see those little saddlebag kind of areas on my thighs, and it's just really, it's hard, because that's something that I can't control or fix, and I feel really affects the way I viewed my shape, which had sort of been hourglassy but now has these extra bits of fat there, and that I definitely find very frustrating. And so those are the days that I really struggle are kind of depending on how my scrub pants fit at work. Do they feel loosey-goosey or not? And I struggle with the validation that my brain automatically wants to provide if they feel loose. So within the last few weeks, I've been really working on getting enough rest, eating regular meals, and making sure that I'm doing that self-care that is necessary so that I can show up for my patients.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I'll even talk about the opposite experience. So this is being recorded in the summer of 2020. And so we have, you know, a year of infamy. You know, we're currently in the middle of a pandemic. And so I had the opposite experience where I think yesterday for the first time I put on jeans and everything feels tight. Right. And so sort of opposite to your brain of like, oh, yay. My brain goes, oh shit. Like, this is tight. This is uncomfortable. And while there's room to be like, okay, well, you know, maybe it's because you haven't worn jeans in a while, there's also a probability that my body is taking a different shape right now. And that can be, it can be uncomfortable.
Sure. And I think it is tough if you've been someone who's been primarily at home, working from home. You know, I'm someone who's still going into an office and who is still fairly busy in that conventional sense, that very capitalist sense that we all love to promote. And, you know, trying to work in healthcare during the pandemic is really exhausting. But I know a lot of people are really worried. They're like, oh, I've been wearing, you know, workout leggings for 3 months. And then the likelihood, though, is those feel different than if you put on jeans. I mean, sure. I put on jeans this morning, a pair that I got from Universal Standard, and they fit just fine, but they feel differently than scrubs or exercise leggings. So
exactly. So you mentioned you wear scrubs, you're a nurse, you're actually a nurse practitioner, right? So tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I am a primary care nurse practitioner. You've probably heard that nurse practitioners are also called mid-level providers. We are nurses with advanced degrees, a master's degree in nursing, and who receive training to assess and diagnose and treat patients the way physicians would, or a physician assistant. And so my focus is on primary care. So sort of your regular doctor's office experience, you know, where you go when you have a sore throat or you need a yearly physical. I happen to work in what's called a federally qualified health center. So these are spaces that are community health centers that are supported by the federal government to provide care for individuals who are the most marginalized. So those without regular access to health insurance or who are underinsured. So mostly a Black and Brown population within Camden, New Jersey, which is a fairly infamous city in and of itself. And I do routine care for individuals. We talk about blood pressure. We talk about blood sugar, diabetes, general wellness, depression, anxiety, aches and pains. We've been doing a lot of testing for COVID-19. So it's, you know, a very broad scope in terms of medical practice.
Wow. Wow. Well, and thank you for continuing to show up even in this pandemic in that space. So thank you very much for that. First let's talk about how, and I asked you this before, but I'll ask you now, how do you identify your body?
I identify as a fat woman. I am a cis queer woman. I'm of mixed race, but I identify as Black. These are sort of recent identifiers that I've really come to own. I would have always said before plus size or chubby, yeah, or fluffy or some other cutesy modifier that seems to make me more palatable.
And why do I identify as fat now? Why is that your choice to identify that?
Because it's a descriptor. It's an adjective, like blue is a color. And it's what my body is. It's not who I am. You know, it's a sort of genetic fact about me, and it's accurate, and I don't see it as pejorative. I was sick of people doing that thing where they say, oh, you're not fat, you're beautiful, or you're big boned, or you're curvy, or all of those other euphemisms that we try to put in there. And I was like, no, it's just fat. Like, it is what it is. It doesn't mean I am not beautiful, or that I'm not intelligent, or I'm not anything else. It just is.
It's reclaiming the word as a descriptive word. Yes. That's my favorite is, you're not fat. I'm like, I'm not.
I know.
It's like, okay, then, you know, what am I?
Exactly. So, yeah. And I feel like to my face, you might want to call me plus size or mm-hmm. something else, but behind my back or on a medical chart, it's going to be deemed a disease and that I'm defective. So,
yeah, we'll definitely come back to that, because I'd love to talk to you about that. But so I'm wondering, as you know, identifying in a person in a larger body, tell me about your journey with how that's impacted how you show up in your workspace.
I would say early in my nurse practitioning career, I was a fairly biased, fat phobic person, because I was operating from this point of like, judge other people before they judge you. And I had a lot of insecurity about being perceived as an incompetent or ineffective healthcare provider because I am fat. You know, I was worried that the message would be, well, how could you take care of me? You can't even take care of yourself. And so I would sort of make different standards for myself. I am fat, but I enjoy exercise, or I'm fat, but I eat salads, like just qualifiers. That trope of being the good fatty.
Yeah.
I had this paradigm shift, after doing a significant amount of reading. I was delving in intuitive eating and sort of the health at every size literature that was available. I think I'd started listening to Christy Harrison's podcast and looking at just different Instagram accounts at the urging of my therapist at the time. I had come out of a very poor relationship, and it was the worst I'd ever felt about myself in life, and was in a very low space. And I knew it was affecting my ability to provide unbiased care to patients because I was projecting my perceived failures onto them. And also, if I can't help people manage their weight or their chronic conditions, then I'm a failure as a healthcare provider. So I really did a lot of work around that in individual therapy. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I was going to adopt this Hayes perspective. I get a lot of questions about, you know, how do I become a Hayes provider, or how do I find a Hayes provider, a health at every size provider? And I'm like, you don't. It's almost like a personal value that individuals have to adopt. There isn't really training in this. There's no sort of board of health at every size providers that you can look up. It really has to be a personal paradigm shift that the individual provider adopts and then decides that that's the perspective from which they're going to practice, you are not going to be prejudiced or biased against people because of the body that they inhabit.
Right. And so, okay. So with that, right. You mentioned that you serve in a marginalized community. If your goal as a nurse practitioner is to teach people about health, right. And there's this misconception that health equals weight loss, right. How does that work with a health at every size paradigm?
It's an uphill battle, I will say, because we are so steeped in diet culture, in wellness culture, so you have a spectrum of people, where it's couched as wellness and lifestyle and healthy behaviors and things like that. I'm also working against a healthcare system that values very particular things. So as a healthcare provider, it's considered, a measure of quality or a part of providing value-based care. So now in healthcare, we're not looking at being how productive can we be. So it's not how many patients can you see in a day. It's are you providing value-based care? So are you helping people meet certain health goals? And so that's looking at how well is their blood pressure controlled? How well is their blood sugar controlled? What is their weight? Have they had a mammogram? Have they had a colonoscopy? All of these sort of tick boxes, and that your provider probably bombards you about, everything from did you get a flu shot to, well, your BMI is X, so now I need to counsel you. Mm-hmm. Provide nutrition and exercise counseling for you. So it's constantly having to push against the diet culture framework. So the way I started framing it with my patients was to use the language of health promoting behaviors. So what are health promoting behaviors that you're familiar with? And, so that there are things that we already talk about. So, physical movement, if you want to call it exercise, go ahead. That's super triggering for some people. So I like to talk about physical movement, joyful movement, nutrition. How do you feed yourself? Not necessarily what you feed yourself, but how do you do it? Do you order out? Do you cook at home? Does a family member cook for you? Do you even have a kitchen? Do you live in an efficiency with a microwave? All of these things. And then what are your goals for yourself? Do you want to do some sort of daily activity because you find that it helps you sleep better and you have less stress if you go to the park and take a walk? Do you even enjoy lettuce or broccoli or any of the things you think you're supposed to be eating, or would making a meal that's more in line with your, food culture, and your budget be more satisfying and nourishing? So, and then we have to talk about, if you take on certain health promoting behaviors, even if that's you want to quit smoking or you don't want to drink alcohol or coffee or you want to have safer sex or any of those things, especially though for nutrition and physical movement, do you still want to do those things even if weight loss doesn't occur? Do you see value and benefit in incorporating certain habits into your daily life, even if you don't lose weight? What are the other benefits? And there are lots you can talk about. Definitely stress reduction, better sleep, better sex life, decreased rates of depression and anxiety, things like that. Better relationships if you're able to connect with people over meals. So I try to frame it in that way. And also that there's a lot of information that we don't know about chronic conditions like diabetes and hypertension, but we practice very sort of racialized medicine. We assume that if you're from a certain race or ethnicity that you're, you just have no shot. You're already going to be you're damned if you're due, you're damned if you don't, you're likely to have one of these. But I try to work from the perspective that even if you do these health promoting behaviors, you might still have high blood pressure and you might still need to use a medication. You might still have diabetes. I think we've been selling people this false bill of goods that if you lose weight, and your A1C falls into a certain range that we consider normal, but then you don't have diabetes. But you do. It's just, is it It's just how well are we able to manage this so that it's not having catastrophic effects? But we sell people this idea that, well, if you lose weight, you won't have this condition.
Right.
You know, and it's not true. And nursing is really, the foundation of nursing is really to help people adapt to whatever is happening in their life. And so rather than trying to fix people or cure them of something, I'm trying to help them adapt to whatever is going on and give them tools that they can use to feel empowered on a daily basis.
Amazing. Oh, that's so good. And it's so needed. As you were talking, I was thinking about the book Body Respect by Lindo Bacon, I think, and also Lucy Aframore, right? Is that, I think that's the author as well. I know Health at Every Size is Lindo Bacon. And right, they, in the book, they talk about how food, like nutrition and exercise, only make up about 30% of health. Yet that is the focus, right? Is that food and nutrition is everything when it's only about 30%.
Exactly. And I would say for most people, mental health is really overlooked. And that especially right now, you know, that living in this time of the coronavirus pandemic, we are talking about health disparities and social determinants of health more and more. And these aren't new things. They are just, it's just the pandemic, like, blew the cellar door wide open so that we could see what was hiding in the basement. Mm. You know, these things have been here. Communities that are experience chronic stress and violence and don't have access to food or safe spaces for movement. If you think about just the protests that have been happening across the country, especially in Black and Brown communities, I mean, would you feel well or healthy if every day of your life you grew up in an area where you experienced some type of violence, whether that was due to domestic or sexual abuse, gun violence, over-policing, lack or even more structural violence, like lack of access to consistent high-quality education, lack of access to consistent sources of high quality nutrition. No, you're not going to be well. So it doesn't matter what your weight is. It doesn't matter what your blood pressure is at that point, because everything else is conspiring to keep you in this system of oppression.
Wow. Yeah. And from a clinical standpoint, we talk about how the body holds on to trauma, right? And that if you're experiencing strife like that every single day and you grew up in this way, of course your body is going to hold on to that. And then I think too, we're also met with this privileged response. And I know that's a hard word for people, right? But it's not, right? It's just saying you have access to things that other people don't, or you don't experience struggles that other people do. And so we were talking off air about how diet culture and wellness culture's response is, you know, just eat a spirulina salad and, you know, and replace all of your meals with this or whatnot. And that comes with privilege that, you know, those salads are ridiculously expensive or those powdered greens are not accessible to all. Right?
No, they definitely are not. And we need to stop telling people that they will be acceptable in our society if they're in a smaller body, because we have thin Black women and we still don't value them. We have thin queer folks, thin trans folks, thin disabled folks, you know, thin folks who don't speak English, just, and they're not valued. They're still othered. So it has nothing really to do with the package you come in. But we tell people that if they work towards this very white Western ideal of beauty, then, okay, you've made it into the club. But that's absolutely not true, nor does it provide care for the entire person.
Absolutely. And it's just like a cookie cutter frame of care as opposed to individualized and holistic care. And, yeah. And you know, like what you were talking about actually made me think of when I was growing up, I went to a weight loss camp. And I remember when I went and realizing I was probably one of the smaller fat people that were at that camp. But then when I came home and I saw people, I was like, wow, like the diversity or the lack of diversity that I'm seeing in my everyday life, like I was able to recognize, huh, I don't think I'm seeing enough people with body diversity. And then at this camp, yeah. Seeing people from all over the United States coming together and realizing, oh, wait, there are more people who look like me.
Yeah, there really are. And I think, you know, obviously there's different levels of fat acceptance,
yes,
in different cultures. Although we tend to fetishize it, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yes.
You know, with, if you think about the whole BBW culture, or, you know, this assumption that men of color prefer larger bodied women, you know, all of these stereotypes that we have come up with. But privilege, definitely, and you know, the diversity that you see in your own community is really important. I know we really push bariatric surgery right now in society, and for an individual, let's say you have Medicaid or Medicare coverage, so those entities will cover the surgery. So they'll cover you having a sleeve gastrectomy, which, let's be real, it's an amputation of your stomach. It's basically cutting off a significant portion of your stomach to make your stomach smaller. Or they're doing the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which is where you change the way your small intestine connects to the stomach, and your stomach is also made smaller. So those are two ways of changing your anatomy to produce malnutrition, which will then produce weight loss. So one of the biggest after effects is that you are at risk for malnutrition and vitamin deficiencies, and you need to hit usually a daily protein quota that they'll give you, a certain amount of grams of protein, which you can't achieve by eating all animal protein. One, with a smaller stomach, it's really uncomfortable to eat that much meat or even eggs or fish or dairy to achieve that protein quota. So what the recommendation often is protein supplements. So in the powdered form or in the shake form, you know, either pre-mixed or you mix your own at home. But let's think about how expensive those supplements are. So Medicaid or Medicare or whatever, you know, managed care organization provides your insurance says, yeah, sure, we'll cover the cost of this surgery and all your follow-ups. Oh, but we're not going to foot the bill for your vitamin B1 or your vitamin B12 or your calcium or your vitamin D or your iron or your protein supplements now that you need to eat 30 small meals a day. Wow. It's not 30 small meals a day.
But yeah, I know. You have to eat.
And so that's not explained in those pre-op visits. And you need to have socioeconomic and racial and class privilege often to access that maintenance diet that you now need to live.
Right. Wow. So. And I feel like this doesn't get talked about at all, or gets talked about very often. But first, I want to say, if you're listening to this and you've had any sort of weight loss surgery, you know, I just want to say that you have the right to body autonomy. You have the right to make decisions over your body. And there's no judgment coming here. I think the reason that I would love to continue this conversation and talk about this is because I know that, so even for myself, when I got surgery, I had the lap band surgery, I was not given enough information on the surgery and what was going to happen. And so, I felt misled by my doctors. And now that I've done research later, one, I mean, they don't, we were just talking about this, they don't really do the lap band surgery anymore.
No, they don't do. I also had the lap band and had to have it removed because of complication. So they don't really do it anymore because, one, they noticed that people who were having this surgery were not achieving the essentially extreme weight loss that they were looking for. So I think, you know, people tended to hover around 50 pounds lost, which is generally what they're not what they're looking for. And then they were noticing what would happen is you would get a secondary constriction under the band. So with the lap band, they're essentially putting almost like a rubber band. It's a band that can be inflated around a portion of the stomach to create constriction so that your less food can go through at a time. So you're eating smaller meals, essentially. But what was happening was a lot of people would develop scar tissue under that band that would create secondary constriction. So even if the band was completely deflated, mm-hmm. the stomach now was stuck in this constricted position, which caused pain and regurgitation and complications for people. So they don't do this procedure anymore.
Wow.
There might be some places that do, but I know most large academic institutions don't offer it anymore.
Now they push the sleeve. And I even know when I went to go get mine removed, it was before I had heard of Health Every Size. So it was 2016. And mm-hmm. I remember feeling like, okay, I don't believe that my body size is because of what I'm eating. Yet you're still trying to control my body to eat less because it's in a larger body. Like, you're not listening to me. Mm-hmm. And they still were pushing it anyway.
Yeah, they asked if I wanted to convert to the sleeve gastrectomy. And I was I said no. Like, I was so uncomfortable with this. Like, God knows what the outcomes of that could be. But I don't discourage my patients from pursuing bariatric surgery. That's not my role. Because as you said, everyone should have autonomy over their own body.
Right.
I work through patients' questions about bariatric surgery. I will give them the referral to go to those practices. And then I try to support them if it's something that they complete. And then we need to work on how to address health and wellness afterwards. But right. I've shared my experience with some of my patients because I have a closer relationship with them.
Sure.
But I would never discourage somebody from doing what they think they need to do because health and wellness is individual. I can't define it for you.
Right.
So if that's something you feel is going to be a good tool for you, then unless I feel it's inherently unsafe or something, then
don't
discourage people.
I'm wondering too, and there's a follow-up question depending on your answer, but like, with your clients, do you find like people who are like, oh, I'm trying this X diet or whatever, and like looking for that, you know, praise or adoration, or like, does that happen in the community that you work in?
All the time, because there's always a new fad.
Right.
I think for the way that it looks in Black and Brown communities is sometimes Herbalife is huge.
Yes.
Definitely those sort of like mid-level marketing type things are big. Body wraps or waist trainers mm-hmm. are also mm-hmm. huge. Or this idea that having a special sweat-inducing outfit that you wear for exercise, like where you look like you're wearing layers of trash bags, but the goal is to have you basically produce a lot of sweat so that it manifests as water weight loss. Mm-hmm. That's also popular. Phentermine and other types of, or Zenical or other types of pills are pretty popular. Mm-hmm. None of which I prescribe. Phentermine, it's a stimulant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's speed. It's legal speed. You know, you could probably get similar effects from using cocaine, and I don't
recommend really cocaine.
Recommend people use cocaine on a daily basis. And all of those things tend to produce very short-term effects. Mm. You know, they're flash in the pan effects. And so I have patients who will say, like, oh, I've lost X amount of weight since I've seen you because I've been doing X, Y, and Z. And my response tends to be, and how do you feel about that? Mm. I try to be neutral. I try not to praise that, but I also don't want to disparage it.
Right.
So I want to talk about, you know, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about whatever you're doing to achieve this?
I think about even too, because right, so I'm not a dietitian, so I have an agency job where I work with, you know, people that have nothing to do with body image. And a lot of times people will try to say, like, oh, I'm doing this, or, you know, I'm on this, you know, X diet or whatnot. And I, you know, just like I would with my, you know, body image patients, I might say, well, how are you feeling? And I oftentimes feel like there's this romanticism, oh, I'm feeling better than I've ever felt before. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying all of the food. And I'm like, okay, it's been like 2 weeks. Like,
Often what we end up enjoying is not the change in our body, it's the increased social capital or social currency that we've gained. So it's the positive attention and the positive reinforcement. So it's family members being like, oh, you look so good, or what are you doing? Oh my gosh, you've been working so hard. We're so proud of you. You look great in that outfit, which basically says you looked awful before, or we didn't accept you before. The hard work that we value is you sticking to a very prescribed diet plan. I will say that for a lot of, depending on sort of, you know, I have some patients who will talk about keto or things like that, but many of those plans or macronutrient counting, things like that, it's very sort of divided by a class and socioeconomic privilege.
Right, for sure.
Do you have the privilege to access, you know, a coach or a very prescribed plan or Weight Watchers or things like that? And now the big one that's coming out, I haven't seen my patients talking about it, but is Noom.
Yes.
So it's advertised everywhere. And even on like NPR, which kills me because I do like to listen to NPR. And they talk about it being almost like CBT, like cognitive behavioral therapy. Like, it's a psychological approach. And I'm like, no, it's not. They're using red, green, and yellow, you know, as an indicator of foods that you should or should not eat. It's still the same. It's still Weight Watchers. It's still Jenny Craig. It's
right. You know, and just with a new name.
Exactly. New name.
Right. And it's like, I think about it from this perspective, but it's like your ex showing up, but they just changed their name. And it's like, oh, but they're different. No, they're the same.
No, but they'll couch it as, but you get like a coach and you have a group and they ask you about your goals and how you're going to reach those goals. You know, they try to, it's like they think if they throw in a motivational interviewing component, it's no longer rooted in diet culture, but it still is, because they'll still tell you on there, because I had used that at one point before I had started therapy, like, turkey is in the yellow category, like, turkey, you know.
like, how are we demonizing, or fruit, like, you know, client was telling
still,
me.
They're still attributing value to foods.
Exactly. And so too, the other thought that I had was, you know, like the way I might counsel somebody through, like, okay, you're going to do this. And what you mentioned this before is, how will you feel if, you know, your body doesn't change? Right? If your body it doesn't create that sustained change that you're hoping for, will that be enough? And I'm wondering, like, does that, do you ask that of your clients as well? And what's their response?
I think the first response, it depends on how long a patient has been with me, but usually the first response is, I'm going to do it and I'm going to see that change. You know, there's a commitment to almost
prove you wrong.
Yes. I never say to someone, you're not going to achieve X, Y, and Z, right. But I just like to posit that question, like, you know, because it can be disappointing when the outcome is not what we expected. So, right. So often at first I get that sort of very intense pushback of, oh, I'm going to do it. You just watch me. And then if it's a patient I've had over several years, it takes many conversations about sort of feelings around this to sort of come to a place of how do they want to take care of themselves in a way that doesn't involve forcing extreme weight loss. And for most people, it's not even extreme weight loss. It literally, like, they, you know, it's 5 or 10 or 20 pounds that they feel are stubborn and that they think they would feel so much better without those things.
Right.
So I try to talk, what activities or habits or in your daily life might make you feel really great and reinforce self-esteem and self-image that don't have to do with purposeful weight loss? Because that's important.
Yeah. And I think it's evidence that body image is a brain issue and not a body issue, because I think about after I lost a significant amount of weight, actually it wasn't that significant. I lost weight after my surgery, and I remember expecting to feel different. And the only thing I felt was, one, discomfort because I couldn't eat a lot of foods. And two, I just was waiting for that confidence to come in. And now I'll look at pictures and I'm like, oh, wow, like how come I couldn't love my body then? and even that just happened recently where I saw pictures from vacation 4 years ago and I'm like, wow. And I thought that was the worst it was going to be. Just showing that it's what's happening in your brain. It's the dialogue that's happening.
Yes.
And that has nothing to do with the health behaviors, right? That has nothing to do with how you feel, right? And if we focus just on how it looks, we're missing on how it feels.
And I think if you're a healthcare provider who works predominantly with marginalized individuals, what happens is those individuals have been chronically undervalued their whole life for a whole host of reasons. And so it really is difficult to convince someone that they don't have to lose weight to be of worth and value. Mm. I think, you know, I definitely had significant privilege in this area because I had access to a therapist that I could work with on these things. And
amazing.
So it didn't take very long for me to sort of come around to the Hayes perspective and to sort of be an activist in this area. But I also grew up in a loving home, in a home where I had access to food and education. And, you know, I also have generational wealth and I have all of those like feel good things that were in place beforehand. Right. And I didn't experience significant adverse childhood events or other trauma. And so I already had a baseline of esteem and confidence to work with. But in individuals who don't even have that baseline, who are chronically devalued by society on the basis of skin color or the language they speak or the religion they practice or the neighborhood that they grew up in, it really is imperative that we not add on another layer by saying, and also we don't like your body.
Wow. I think,
like, a major goal for me had been, I don't think I wanted to be thin. I don't know if I wanted to be thin per se, but one thing I did want was to have the ability to go into my closet and pull something out and know that it fit. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I think this resonates with a lot of people. Like, I spent most of my life yo-yoing between so many sizes that, you know, in the fall, I could start out as one size and come back around to the next fall and nothing would fit because I had spent the entire year trying to achieve this nebulous ideal. And I've reached a point now where I am in a larger body than I was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, but everything in my closet fits.
Wow.
Which is nice. Yeah. So I can have a smaller wardrobe. I'm not constantly buying clothes. I'm not constantly having these sort of aspirational outfits hanging out in the back of my closet. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I feel good and comfortable because I have things that I feel good wearing that feel good in my body, on my body. And I think that that definitely produces real joy. And I think that everyone should deserves that, to be able to go to their dresser or their closet and to know that no matter the size of the body they inhabit, there are clothes in there that fit. Right. You know, yes, we all have to have a transition period, because if you're coming out of disordered eating, you know, then, you know, there was a
transition
time for me too. But now I'm at a point where it's like, yep, I can order this size. And
my set weight point, my body has, right? And so the set weight point, Linda Bacon talks about it in Health at Every Size, is the weight that your body is meant to be at. And it's like, I think it fluctuates a little bit, but after years of dieting, it's going to take time for your body to come back to that place of homeostasis. Right. And so two thoughts on that. As you were talking, I was thinking about ice, right? If you put ice water in the freezer, right, it's only going to be able to fluctuate its shape for so long. And then eventually it's going to go back to the shape it's supposed to be. And that's hard for people as they think, oh, but I'm not supposed to be this shape. Well, you can't know until you have stopped dieting, because when you diet, you are creating this weight cycling, which is not giving your body an opportunity to rest or to figure out, hey, where am I supposed to be at? What is comfortable for me to be at? And then I think this is probably one of the biggest things that comes up for people with me when I'm working with body image, is their clothes are changing. Their clothes are not fitting. And it's probably because they're trying to fit into clothes that aren't meant to fit them, but it is hard. I leave space for that. And so my recommendations typically are size up, right? You know, don't be afraid to size up and wear looser, like fitting clothes until you can figure out where your body is going to regulate and where it is going to maintain that homeostasis.
And when we stop that sort of chronic dieting cycle, we stop seeing those extreme weight swings. So, you know, your weight will fluctuate throughout life, which I get this comment a lot, which is like, well, I've always been X weight or size, but now that I'm X age, and I was like, right, bodies change over life. Like you're never going, especially if you're a female bodied person and you've given birth to children, there's no way. Well, some people can maintain very small bodies, but the reality is that like you will likely not look the same as you did in high school. Just, you know, and that's hard, but it's the same thing as like, we have a real issue in this country, just acknowledging like that bodies age and they can become sick and they can have injuries because we are really stuck on this fountain of youth perspective that's sold by all these influencers,
right, that you never age and your hair never changes color and you never get wrinkles and we can prevent it all. And one, that comes with a lot of privilege, and two, right, you're trying to stop time and that's not possible. And talking about the mental health of it is like, it's exhausting. It is exhausting to have to think about all of the things that you have to do to show up in the world. And I think for me, that's one of the best things about quarantine is I'm still in pajamas right now. as we're recording this, and I'm just cozy and comfy, and I don't feel like I need to perform or show up as much. And that's because we live in a world that demands that we show up. And the one quote that I want, go ahead, and then I'll read this quote.
I was just thinking that, you know, if you and I are talking about how mentally exhausting it is to have to show up in this way, like the fact that we are expecting people with significantly less privilege to meet that benchmark too. Like, you know, this is why being a healthcare provider or being health at every size, like it has to be anti-racist work as well. It can't be, you know, it cannot be inherently misogynistic. It cannot be, you know, transphobic. It cannot be anti-Black. Because we need to make sure that when we are promoting health and wellness, we promote it, we allow everyone access to the same health promoting behaviors.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And I mean, it's such an issue because it's so deep and there's so much that has to change. But you know, I think that even just you and I starting like, and having these conversations, your clients are so incredibly lucky to have a provider who cares for their health and well-being and not their weight. And that's not their focus. And what I was going to share too, is that you mentioned about like, you know, your sort of your why. I mean, I know for me, my why was about feeling belonging. And there's a Brené Brown quote that says the opposite of belonging is fitting in. Fitting in is accessing and acclimating. And I think that, I think that people are desperate to feel like they belong. And the truth is you do belong. And I think that's the one caveat that dieting has, is it offers community like nothing else other than that AA.
Oh yes, it offers a way to, I mean, if I even just think about, you know, my relationships, you know, with my mother or with other women, it was always a bonding experience. And this is the first time in my life, I'm 35, you know, for barometer here, where I have fat friends and not just like not small fat friends, like where I have a diversity of fat friends and where, you know, it feels like I have my own personal hype group because they don't, well, we don't do diet talk, but they don't allow, we can talk about having a bad body day. Like we will openly share that. And there's never feedback that's like, well, if you tried X, you might feel better, which is what happens in diet culture. It's like, well, have you thought about taking up running or have you thought about, you know, eating this or trying this recipe, which was always the feedback. And now the feedback that I get is you are perfectly fine as you are. You're going to, you know, I'm so sorry you're having this really crappy day. How can I support you? But don't even for a minute think that you are not an acceptable human being, which is a very different response than I had ever gotten before, especially growing up. You know, if I expressed discomfort or dissatisfaction with my body, it was always like, well, if you did something different, you wouldn't have those feelings. Mm-hmm.
And what I find in those moments, it is a scapegoating of our body. Right? It's, well, my body is the problem rather than, okay, well, you don't feel comfortable in your body. Let's talk about it. Let's lean into that. It's often
rooted in something totally different.
Absolutely.
You know? And if I ask patients that, you know, what about your body feels uncomfortable or why are you suddenly worried that you're going to die of a heart attack or something? Usually it comes out, well, this is the experience that I had, or this is my trauma that I've had. And it's manifesting itself in this sort of physical way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's important to address with people. And it's important to address in primary care. You know, mental health is the new frontier of healthcare right now. And it's very obvious that there's such a lack of access for most people.
Yeah.
And so it's not as easy as being like, well, let's hook you up with this great therapist that you've got to pay $200 an hour for. So you have to interrogate these things when people bring them up in primary care. You are the first line of defense. I'm sure, I don't know if you heard this in school, but this has always stuck in my brain that most people who attempt suicide saw their primary care provider within a short period of time before that suicide attempt.
Never heard that. Wow.
Yeah. And so I always think about that when I have colleagues who are like, well, I don't deal with depression or anxiety. You know, I just deal with medical stuff. Mm-hmm. But so much physical and mental well-being are so interconnected. And, you know, physical problems can often manifest from depression and anxiety and other forms of distress. And so I always try and think about that like,
yeah,
if you're complaining about discomfort in your body, what else could be going on?
Yeah. Oh, that's so powerful. And I think that's, you know, I think about it too, like my primary care, they always, when we go in for like a routine check, it's like, have you been feeling sad more times than not? Right. Like that basic depression question. And I think too, people think, oh, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. And so we put this threshold of, well, it's fine. Whereas can we use that as an indicator of, okay, maybe it's not great. What can we do? What is in our ability to help you right now? What resources does your community have that we can offer you?
People have a really hard time, I think,
yeah,
working with those scales, you know, PHQ-2 or the PHQ-9, which are different depression scales that we can use in a clinical setting. So things I try and listen for, you know, when it comes to like body dissatisfaction or discomfort, or, you know, a feeling of heaviness, a feeling of fatigue, pain, especially in joints or the back, or difficulty sleeping. In Spanish speaking cultures, people will often say that they have a lot of nerves, or they have a lot of tension or anxiety, tengo nervios kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's in the way that people might express, you know, these underlying body image issues or depression or anxiety or trauma. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely important that we listen to when people are having like that a bad body image day really is probably not about the way that you look in jeans.
Amen. And that can be so hard separating that out. And so one of the things I encourage my clients to do, my Instagram followers to do, is we have to build the awareness around connection. So is this because I'm feeling physical discomfort, or am I beating myself up because I'm feeling physical discomfort? Am I blaming myself? Or my, right, like the, how everyone thinks it's a matter of willpower, right? Or, you know, I'm just not showing enough restraint. And instead of going into that fix it mode of just be building that awareness of, I'm feeling physical discomfort right now. And there's space for that. And so I'm a short person, and I shared this on a previous episode. If I go to the store and I can't reach something on the top shelf, it's uncomfortable, but I don't feel shame for it because I don't actually believe I have control over my height.
Yes, exactly.
There is a misconception that people think, but I can control my weight. And the science just isn't there to produce it. That there is no empirical research that shows sustained weight loss for, I think it's more than 5 years.
Very unlikely.
Right. For less than 5% of people, or for the 95% of people, that we don't see those results. And so
we purposefully create spaces in which people will have to become very aware of their body shape and size. So I think the most obvious is like if you get on an airplane, you know, yeah. Yes, the idea is, well, you have control over your body size. So if you made your body size smaller, you would fit in this airplane seat and you would be comfortable and the person next to you wouldn't be throwing shade. But really, no, that's the purview and responsibility of the airline industry to make aircraft that are safe and comfortable for passengers, but yeah, they are focused on profits and getting the most people they can on an aircraft to boost those profits. So they don't care who fits in the seats.
Wow.
They're happy to take double your money so you can buy two seats or whatever it is. But, you know, or restaurants where, you know, I'm so sick of these cafe chairs that are like tin cans. They construct, it's like, I literally feel like, did you take a tuna fish can and make a chair out of this? I know it looks like hipster chic and, you know, repurposed industrial, but this is not comfortable for anyone, you know, and it don't put arms on things and make sure there's enough space between tables, because if this space doesn't work for a fat person, it doesn't work for a disabled person.
Exactly.
It doesn't work for anyone who uses a mobility device or any type of other assistance. And so the, you know, the levels of exclusion that are purposely built into society, there's, you know, it's very targeted and purposeful.
It's very targeted. It's very purposeful. And it's meant to be exclusionary. And, and I think that there are times too, where I think, okay, maybe a restaurant is like, oh, but this chair does look cute and chic. When I buy furniture now, I think I want my largest friend to feel comfortable in my home. I want to make sure that everyone feel, I want to make sure that I have a space that if I have, you know, if my, you know, friends who struggle or friends with disabilities, right? And they need accessibility, that I have options for them. Like if stairs are right, we want those options for people so that they feel like you're welcome here. You are welcome here. So I feel like I could talk to you forever. I feel like we could talk all day long.
I know. It's a real shame now that we really like can't hang out with people, because I feel like, you know, you make new connections during this quarantine time and you're like, okay, well, I guess I'll see you.
I'll see you in 21.
22. Yeah.
And we're not that far from each other. So we definitely have the ability to hang out in real life. But tell people where they can find you.
So I am on Instagram under csuzgo. So literally C with your eyes, S-U-Z, and then G-O. Shout out to my friend who helped me out with that. My Instagram handle before was really complicated. And unfortunately, I get this question a lot. I don't have a private practice. So I practice in New Jersey at a federally qualified health center. So if you live in New Jersey and you have New Jersey insurance, you are welcome to hit me up on Instagram and you could come to our practice. But I don't, because of the laws for nurse practitioners, we can't practice, like set up our own practice. So, yeah. I am licensed in Pennsylvania, but I don't practice in Pennsylvania anymore. Okay. So, and so I don't know where I'll be in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years or what the landscape will look like for nurse practitioners, but I'm happy to have conversations over Instagram. That's the easiest way to reach me.
Maybe, you know, maybe you come on my page, we'll do a live or something, and we'll do some stuff in the future, because you are a wealth of knowledge and experience, and I was honored to learn from you today and to have this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.
Hey, thanks for joining me for this episode of Body Image with Bree. If you like what you heard, please feel free to leave a comment below or share this link with somebody you care about. If you are interested in learning more about how you can work with me, you can email me at bodyimagewithbree@gmail.com. And for more podcast episodes in which I've been a guest on, you'll find that in the link tree in my Instagram. Thanks again for being here, and until next time.